This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. John Wells is out today. It's widely understood that Charles Darwin's theory of evolution completely revolutionized the study of biology. Yet, according to my next guest, David Sloan Wilson, the Darwinian revolution won't be truly complete until it is applied more broadly to everything associated with the words human, culture, and policy. Wilson joins me to explore this complete theory of evolution from the breeding of hens to the timing of cataract surgeries to the organization of an automobile plant. Wilson says that if we can become wise managers of the evolutionary processes, we can solve the problems of our age at all scales, from the efficacy of our groups to our well-being as individuals to our stewardship of the planet Earth. David Sloan Wilson, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much.
David, you ask your reader to set aside what you currently think you know about evolution. And so maybe you should remind our listeners what we all currently know about the theory of evolution.
Well, most people associate evolution with biology and genes. And so in that area, Darwin's theory has proven itself very, very well. But people don't associate evolution with words such as human, culture, and especially policy. So for me, completing the Darwinian revolution will be when Darwin's theory makes sense of those other words in addition to the word biology.
And so why do you think we stop short, really, of seeing this full revolution into socio-cultural, anthropological expressions of the theory and away from just the biological ones that we have known about for so long?
Yeah, that's a great question, because Darwin definitely thought and wrote about his theory as something that would apply to the length and breadth of humanity in addition to the natural world. But for complex reasons, evolution became very what I call gene-centric, as if the only way that offspring can resemble their parents is by sharing genes. And so the concept of cultural evolution, and also the interesting concept of personal evolution, the fact that we are flexible as individuals and that our capacity for change can be understood with the same ideas, basic ideas, as for genetic evolution. These became seeded to other disciplines during the 20th century. And so we have all of the human-related disciplines, anthropology, psychology, sociology, economics, the humanities, all developed these ideas about humans in their own ways, but not in connection with evolutionary theory and sometimes in perceived opposition. And that's the very complex and fragmented, disunified situation that needs to be addressed.
Well, it's so interesting to me that it seems like, since the time that we've been doing this show, Cool Science Radio, about the last 6 years or so, we have noticed more and more that various disciplines in science and sociology and anthropology that formerly existed in silos are now starting to realize the interdependence of scientific study and cultural study, sociological study, and weaving these things together, which makes perfect sense for exactly what you're doing. I just find that so interesting. Why is it happening now, and why didn't it happen before?
I'm really happy, Lynn, that you made that observation. It's absolutely correct that things started to get back on track around the 1980s or 90s, and now it's in full swing. There's many excellent people involved. One of my favorite colleagues at the University of Utah is Bruce Ellis, who does fabulous work on these. We could talk about his work. And so what we have now is a community of really thousands of people that are back on track with this. So that's a large number, and yet it's still a very tiny fraction of the worldwide scholarly and scientific community. And when we get to the world of policy, then that's even further behind. So the good news is that we have this vibrant community that more or less already gets it and I talk about a lot of those folks in my book, but that's still a tiny fraction of what needs to be accomplished. So that's the current situation.
I'm glad that you brought up Bruce Ellis at the University of Utah. We have so many wonderful things going on at that university, and I'm glad you mentioned him. We'll look him up and maybe invite him on our show.
Oh, yeah, he does great things with child development.
So you're by training, or what you do every day in your job, you're an evolutionary biologist. Whenever we speak with an evolutionary biologist, we find out the most interesting things. But shouldn't you really be called an evolutionary anthropologist, I guess, with what you're putting forth with this book, this view of life?
Well, I call myself an evolutionist because when we talk about evolution covering all of the human-related disciplines, plus the computational fields, evolutionary algorithms and things like that, but there's basically no living process, therefore no human process, which is cannot be understood within this framework, then it really evolutionary should not be an adjective. It should not be an adjective tacked on to some noun. It should be the noun. So an evolutionist is someone who basically uses evolution, this view of life, to study everything that's living.
Yeah. Well, let's work into some examples that you bring forth in the book. I mean, starting with Darwin and his theory of natural selection, if we go back to when we all first learned about that in whatever level of education that we did, it pretty simple, natural selection. Individuals vary. Their differences often have consequences for survival and reproduction. And this goes into, as you mentioned before, heredity. And that's sort of where we leave off in the story. So maybe give an example of that, and then let's move into culture and human and policy.
Right. So thank you for stating the three ingredients of the theory. And then what happens next is, of course, organisms become adapted to their environments. A game I like to play with my audiences is that I show them a desert environment, and I ask them the question, what color do you think all of the organisms in this environment are? It doesn't matter whether it's a bird, mammal, snail, insect. What color do you think they are? And they all answer, sandy colored. And then I show them a desert in which the sand is black. And I say, what color do you think the organisms are here? Black, they say. Then I show them a desert where the sand is white. What color? White, they say. And so then I just unpack that, basically.
Yeah.
You know, what? In order for that to be true, and it is true, by the way, then all of those creatures had to actually vary in their coloration. And then those that matched their background were the ones that survived and reproduced. So that's when people are thinking like evolutionists. And the real puzzle, actually, is to take that very, very simple way of thinking, only needs to be elaborated a little bit, and then to apply that to some of the real problems that confront us. So why is it that we have so much social dysfunction? Why do we have so much physical dysfunction? Why do we have these diseases of civilization that represent a mismatch between the way we evolved in past environments interacting with our present environments? How do we raise our children? In what ways are we raising our children that we think are right and yet turns out to be wrong? And here's where Bruce Ellis comes in, by the way. But so the toolkit is what I call very intuitive, easy to understand, but its great generality is what really needs to come across, basically, and is the main goal of my book, is to show how these can function as a practical toolkit.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Sloan Wilson. He's written a new book called This View of Life, Completing the Darwinian Revolution. And was that your play on words from the theory of evolution and then the Darwinian Revolution, or has it always been referred to as a revolution in biology?
I think it was referred to as a revolution. I don't feel that I was being original about that, although it is fun to call oneself an evolutionary rather than a revolutionary. I like that particular variant. But this view of life is from the final passage of Origin of Species, where Darwin says there is grandeur in this view of life. And one of the things I try to get across in the book is I say that evolution is not actually just a theory, because a theory only tells you what is. Evolution can also be a worldview, and a worldview tells us what to do. So there's a sense in which these ideas can be animating in a way, frankly, that a religion is animating. Why is religion so important, including the Mormon religion? It animates you. Mm-hmm. It makes sense of the world in a way that actually instructs how you act. And for the most part, results, a good religion results in strong communities. And of course, there's always a dark side and all that. So part of this, by the way, is the study of religion from an evolutionary perspective. And religions over time and history being a great bushy tree of cultural evolution.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that when we leave the talk of biology and natural selection and we move move towards talking about social Darwinism, and you mentioned this in your book, is that it's had some very negative impacts, for example, justifying genocide. I think Hitler used a lot of justification from Darwin's theory of evolution, natural selection, to go about his business. And so could you talk to that a little bit? You know, why is that? It seems like that's where then we want to stop talking about social Darwinism, because it leads us down a really ugly path.
Yeah, and chapter one is devoted to that. And it's titled Dispelling the Myth of Social Darwinism. Mm-hmm. So here are some quick points that are made at greater length in the book. Number one, any idea that can be used as a tool can also be used as a weapon. That is true for any tool and any idea. In some ways, evolution is no different than that. Number two, it's just plain false to say that evolution was especially a problem in leading to these, in being used as a weapon. And to take the case of Hitler, not true at all that he was not a Darwinian, and that's part of that chapter. He was actually, he disbelieved in Darwin. He got his ideas about race and so on from other sources. Point three is that if you look at the actual history of evolutionary thinking, it includes people such as John Dewey, the beloved social reformer and educator, who did draw upon Darwin very much so. So at the end of the day, what we have is a social Darwinism being used as a kind of a bogeyman. We say social Darwinism, and then that scares people away. We have to be more sophisticated than that. And then we have to think of this as a tool that can be used for great good. And also, of course, we want to prevent it from being used as a weapon, because it can be. And so that's the, I think, more sophisticated and constructive way to think about any theory, any tool, including the theory of evolution.
I like that clarification. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
So you talk about how there's a practical toolkit that you can extract when you talk about this evolutionary worldview. And you apply it to some fun examples. The breeding of hens, for example.
I've used that example for decades, and it never grows old, so I'm happy to report it to... it was an experiment for increasing the productivity of hens. And the hens were in groups and cages. And very simply, you pick the most productive hen in each cage to breed the next generation of hens. What's not to like about that? And yet what happened was the opposite. Egg productivity went down, and the hens became extremely aggressive, because what you were actually doing was selecting the biggest bully. It was the biggest bully that laid the most eggs in each cage. And so in five generations, you had bred a nation of psychopathic chickens. And this is so so interesting. In a parallel experiment, the whole cages were selected. The most productive cages were selected rather than the most productive hen within each cage. And those evolved to be cooperative and productive and docile and laid a lot of eggs. So this is, of course, important in its own right because it shows you that evolution is taking place whether we want it to or not. It's taking place in our domesticated animals, and we should be careful about what we select for. But it also serves as a parable for human social interactions, not necessarily genetic human evolution, but human cultural evolution. That I tell the story that when I gave that chicken example in the lecture once, a professor ran up to me afterwards and said, "That first chicken experiment describes my department. I have names for those mean chickens." So just imagine a department that rewards its members for their individual productivity and not for anything cooperative. What are you going to get? You're going to get selfish, self-serving faculty members.
If you take this example, David, of the breeding of hens, and as you use the word sociopath, so you replace hens with sociopath, you know, the breeding of sociopaths, if you look at business, at the culture of business now, today, any of the business books out there are telling you that we are moving away from this concentration of power as CEOs and leaders tended to have sociopathic tendencies. And now we're moving into a culture of empathy and collaboration. It sort of proves your point about cultural evolutionary theory, doesn't it?
It does, Lynn, and it proves a lot of points. One of the things it proves is the power of theory, basically. The major theme of my book is that the theory decides what you can observe. A theory or any worldview, including a religious worldview, provides a kind of a lens that tells you what to pay attention to, how you process that information, and ultimately how you act. And so if you have a theory which says that the only responsibility of a corporation is to maximize profits for its shareholders, which is what Milton Friedman said, and that somehow if we all just pursue our self-interest, we'll be led as if by an invisible hand to benefit the common good. If that's your theory, then you will act upon it. But what you have done is really set up a social environment like that chicken experiment. But a theory that tells you that actually we need to cooperate to compete, and that that's true for businesses no less than any other kind of group, and that groups are actually a fundamental unit. The one constant in our evolutionary past is that we lived in small and highly cooperative groups. And our brains and bodies evolved against that background. So that means when you remove an individual from nurturing groups, then it's like removing an ant from the ant colony. It's going to be highly stressful, and that ant or human are going to be doing things which are not necessarily very sensible. And so armed with the right theory, then this current trend in business that we need to, guess what, we need to be empathetic, we need to be nurturing, we don't need to be so hierarchical, we can operate in teams, all of these things which makes sense against some perspectives, that's why they're currently becoming popular, really get a powerful justification from this view of life and evolutionary worldview.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. Well, how does your theory the whole evolution of the theory, how does it lend itself to talking about the timing of cataract surgeries?
Well, I have a whole chapter called Policy is a Branch of Biology that's intended to break down this barrier when we think biology means one thing, human culture and policy means something else. And there's three stories told within that chapter. The first one is cataract surgery. Cataracts usually exist in old people, but occasionally they exist in newborns. And at first, doctors thought that they would wait, that they should wait until the infant grows a little bit older before replacing the cataract with an artificial lens, because they didn't want to operate on such small infants. But when they did that, they discovered that those people remained profoundly vision impaired. This was a surprise to them. What they didn't understand is that eye development actually requires an interaction between the developing eye and brain and the environment. And that if you take that away, then the eye cannot develop. And not only is that true for cataracts, but it's true for all of us, and explains why so many of us must wear glasses. Now, why is it that anyone who is myopic is vision impaired? And if we didn't have glasses, of course, that would be catastrophic. What's mm-hmm. that about? It turns out that the modern environment is sufficiently different from our ancestral environment that it creates this mismatch. It disrupts eye development. This is called evolutionary mismatch, and it has many, many manifestations. Probably the culprit is that spending time indoors under low ambient light levels. And so it turns out that if kids spend a lot of time outdoors, then they're much less likely to become nearsighted than kids that spend a lot of time indoors. Knowing that, we can do something about it. So that's why we need biology in order to formulate a policy. And that's the theme for the whole book in that chapter.
Formulate a policy of how we ought to conduct our culture as humans. Before I let you go, David, I have to ask you, we've done a couple of interviews recently about CRISPR technology and the controversy. Obviously, there is a lot of controversy on how far do you do it? What's the ethical and the moral limit of using genetic engineering? And I'm just wondering how the Darwinian revolution, how that all fits in, because you think, well, we evolve and our science evolves and our application of science evolves and our policy evolves. And where does it all fit in to the outer reaches of things like CRISPR technology?
Right. Well, that is a good note to end on. I think a major theme of my book is that evolution goes beyond genetic evolution. It includes the fast-paced processes taking place around us and even within us. And also, unmanaged evolution takes us where we don't want to go. We have to align evolutionary forces with our normative goals. And there's no real firewall between managing cultural evolution or personal evolution and managing genetic evolution. There's no fundamental reason why we can't manage the process of genetic evolution. I think what makes that scary, and what makes all policies scary, is when it's done without our consent. Mm. And so when we decide to do something together by consensus, it won't necessarily be the right choice, but it's going to be our best shot at making a wise decision that we are happy to live with. It's when some people make decisions and we have no consent, and so things are being done to us and we're powerless to stop them, that things really get insidious. And that is true for all policies, so whether it's cultural, personal, or genetic. So I think we should be concentrating on creating the social environment in which we can decide what to do for our collective benefit, the global benefit, first and foremost, and long-term, not short-term. If that's the framework for us to make decisions of all sorts, then that will also do for what we decide about our genetic evolution.
Mm. It's interesting. It really speaks to the responsibility that we have to use that toolkit of social evolution, understanding what it is. And I suppose that's your argument for why we ought to pick up your book.
Well, against the background of social Darwinism, where we think it's been used to justify inequality, the real mm-hmm. message of evolution and the real message of my book is that it provides a powerful justification for a whole earth ethic. I dedicate the book to all who are reaching for an ethics of the whole world. It's actually very convergent with His Holiness the Dalai Lama's book called Beyond Religion, Towards an Ethics for the Whole World. And isn't it interesting that that's the real message of evolution once you understand it correctly?
Really enjoyed this conversation. David Sloan Wilson is my guest, and his book is This View of Life, Completing the Darwinian Revolution. David, thanks so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. Keep up the good work.
All right. Thanks.